It's generally accepted that one of the goals of any theorist working on quantum Hall effect is to try to derive a low-energy theory starting from the first principles using a series of approximations. So I'm going to describe to you one such theory that was worked in collaboration with Murthy, but I find myself in a very tough situation here because since I talked about this last year at ITP, I have about twice as many results and twice as many jokes and half the time to deliver them. So I have to make some rules which I'm forced to do, and I hope you will understand. One is that I cannot use the blackboard, in spite of having a wonderful thing here. I have to use the transparency machine. Second is that I won't be able to give you any historical perspective and refer to all the works this depends on. So that's going to anger not only the 200 people in this room, but because of this internet, about 200,000 people. 200,001, because I forgot Linda Tripp, who listens to everything. Okay, third thing is, cannot have any questions during the talk, but probably at the end. I'm not trying to dodge your questions. At the right time and place, I will testify completely and truthfully. And as for the lack of jokes, I should say that in their place, I'll give you some physics arguments you might find far more amusing. So what I'm going to do in the short time I have is try to convince you that the proposal we have is actually very simple. So I want to emphasize the simplicity of this, and if at the end you think the whole thing is trivial, I'll be very happy because Feynman has told us that if you understand something, you should be able to explain it to a freshman. I think I can explain this to a senior who has done some quantum mechanics. So let me start with that goal of just telling you as if this were a lecture. So let's start with the electrons in the magnetic field. That's equation one. Then we do this famous Chern-Simons transformation. By the way, as far as Chern-Simons goes, I think people know my view on that was inspired by President Kennedy. I have a little quotation from him, which is to basically not worry about theory, just get some mileage out of it. So that's all I want to do. So I won't get into why that is done. This is what you do. You trade the problem for a new problem. The new wave function has a new factor in front of it, where phi ij is the phase of the complex number zi minus zj, if you use complex coordinates in the plane. If you do that, then this new Hamiltonian will contain an extra term, and that's the Chern-Simons field coming from taking derivatives of this extra factor. And it's not an external field, it's the field whose curl is controlled by the particles themselves. They are the source of the field. So why do we do this? Basically, we know from Laughlin's idea that at the average level, you can somehow compensate a large fraction of this field with the field produced by these particles. In particular, if you're at filling factor nu, given by this, then the inverse of that is the flux per particle, number of flux quanta per particle. What I'm doing there with the 2s is to kill the 2s here, leaving you with 1 over p flux quanta per particle, and that's the theory of fermions that see a weaker field, and they will fill exactly p lambda levels. This is the idea that Jane has been propagating as a way to get excellent wave functions, and Fradkin and Lopez did the Chern-Simons theory for that, and then the delicate case when you approach p equal to infinity was originally studied by Karl Mayer and Zhang and then completely demolished by this threesome here, the other problem on nu equal to half. So that's the route I want to take, go to the case of fermions, but I should just mention for completeness that if p is equal to 1, then 2s plus 1 is another integer, and instead of the 2s, you can put a 2s plus 1, get rid of all the flux. Then you get bosons, and that's the general idea of Gerwin and MacDonald, Reed and this order parameter, Chern-Simons theory of Zhang, Hansen, Kivelson, and Lee and Zhang. So we are going to be doing the one where you always work with fermions. Since I'm not referring to anybody, I cannot refer to our own work, other than to say that there's a Kahn mat somewhere. This is the last of the Kahn mats with Park and Jane, and from that You can work your way back to any earlier references. Okay, so once you've done the churn center transformation and subtracted out the average, this is what you will get. You'll get Hamiltonian fermions that see a weaker field, A star, weak enough to fill P Landau levels. And then this A with a colon on it is the A from which the average field has been subtracted. So that's the problem one wants to solve. And usually this is what one means by the composite fermion of Chern-Simons theory. But we wanted to go a little beyond this point for the following reasons. First of all, this A is not a given external field. It's a very complicated object. Its curl is the particle density. It is really, in momentum space, the density over Q. So when you expand it out, it's got two-body and three-body interactions. So it's a very difficult Hamiltonian to work with. Secondly, by this phase transformation, we have attached only the flux to the particles, but not the zeros. Now, it's pointed out long back by Halperin that if you look at Laughlin's wave functions, the electrons are bound to the zeros in the wave function, not just to the phase factors. And Nick Reed has emphasized always that it's the zeros that really have a charge deficit to which the electron would even be attracted in the first place. It's not attracted to just the flux tubes. So what you really want to do is to find a theory where you can attach not the flux of the zeros, but the whole zeros. So Rajaraman and Sondhi had a plan where you do a different transformation where in the exponential that I showed earlier, instead of the phase of zi minus zj, you put all of zi minus zj. Then you can get the zeros in, but then the vector potential will be complex. You can still work with that, but I will show you a different approach that we have where you get essentially the same effect. So this is our trick, sort of inspired by some ancient work of Bohm and Pines. And it proceeds as follows. So here's the pi and the normal ordered A. Then I'm going to introduce a new transverse vector potential into this problem. In other words, the Hilbert space will be enlarged to include this new vector field. And it's going to be best understood in momentum space. So at each value of Q, in two dimensions, the transverse field is only one component. That let me call A without an arrow. That's going to be introduced as a new coordinate. It'll have a conjugate momentum, which is called P. With that, I build a longitudinal vector potential. And I introduce these into the problem, and I modify my Hamiltonian by including this A. Of course, the problem will be different from the one we posed ourselves, unless we work on vectors that obey the condition A acting on the vector is zero. And all eigenvectors will be eigenstates of A. With commutes to the Hamiltonian, you should work on those for which A times the state is zero. So this looks like just the wrong thing to do, to bring in even more degrees of freedom when you're trying to reduce a theory to its minimal parts, but you will see in a minute why we do that. The whole idea of bringing this new vector field A is that since it's a free variable, we can shift it by the minus of this bad Chern-Simons spectral potential. So how will you shift that? Then we know from basic quantum mechanics that if you want to shift something, you take the exponential of the momentum, conjugate to that thing, and you multiply it by whatever shift you want. So this will shift A by minus the Chern-Simons term. So with this unitary transformation, you now get a new Hamiltonian in which you will find that Chern-Simons thing is gone. You have this A, which is now in an independent variable. You also have this one more term because U not only acts on A, but acts on the particles. So it produces an extra phase shift. But if you take the gradient, you basically knock out this Q, and you get this extra term. So the Hamiltonian for us looks like the kinetic momentum of the fermions and a longitudinal and transverse vector field. But the physical states now, instead of obeying A equal to zero, will obey this condition. It's the usual Chern-Simons condition. But it's now a condition on the state vectors, which we must impose if you want to go back to the problem we set out to solve. So you should imagine now what will happen if you take this Hamiltonian and just expand everything out. So you can expect a square of this and a square of this and a cross term. So let's look at that Hamiltonian. It's got the terms I mentioned here. So this is the pi squared term. The second one is the a plus p whole squared term. And then there is a cross term. There's one more term, which I call non-RPA, which corresponds to fluctuations in that F. That will never play a role in what I do. So notice the second term looks like a coordinate square plus momentum square. It's obviously a harmonic oscillator. And you can introduce harmonic oscillator raising and lowering operators. And you see it's got something at the cyclotron frequency omega naught, but reduced by this factor, which is one only at half filling. Otherwise, it's a very high energy, but not exactly the right energy to be the cyclotron in this problem. So just with this Hamiltonian, you can learn some interesting things. For example, if you just forget this interaction terms and look at the first two terms, you can write down the ground state wave function. It will look like some oscillator A square for each A and P for Landau level for the fermions. But then in the physical sector, you should replace A by rho over Q. If you do that, everything becomes in terms of Chern-Simons fermion coordinates, and you'll get the modulus of these usual Jastrow factors. And if you go back to electrons, you'll get the whole Jastrow factor. So this is what Rajaraman Sondhi did with the complex vector potential. But we get this here by using a vector potential with longitudinal parts. Then upon projection, you get the whole wave function. Okay, CP1 is a reminder that I have a marvelous little joke that does not fit into these narrow margins. So, but I think I will take a risk with the time and tell you what it is. CP refers to Colin Powell. So you know that whenever I have difficulties, I consult typical American heroes for what to do. So Ganapati and I went and asked the general for this Hamiltonian, and he said, we have these unwanted degrees of freedom. They're bothering us. What should we do? And he said, you should isolate them, and then you should kill them. So what he really meant, of course, was you shouldn't have these cross terms between your fermions and the particles. He said, I don't see any quenching in the kinetic energy of the fermions. And he said, the Kohn's theorem is violated. But no one violates Kohn's theorem. He didn't actually say violate, but used a much more colorful expression. But he got the message across in half as many letters. Okay, so we knew we had to decouple these two things. And we were sort of protesting that it's very hard to decouple this interaction. So he said, gentlemen, you must take a long view of the problem. By that he meant you should work in the infrared limit, where if you work in the smallest powers of Q, you can decouple this. So with that kind of help, it was not hard to figure out what you have to do. Because you got this quadratic term in A, and this A plus B is a linear term in A, you can see how much you must shift the A to kill the cross terms. That'll be some unitary operator that looks like A times is pi and a pi times is A, so it was not hard to work out exactly what it is. So we worked it out, and we got rid of the cross terms. So what we're trying to do is, we got particles, and we got these high-energy oscillators, and they are coupled, and rather than getting rid of one or the other, we get rid of the coupling between them. So this way you can see what happens to both at the end. So this is what the Hamiltonian looks like when you do that. Notice the oscillators have now come to the correct frequency given by Kohn's theorem. We have done the only unitary transformation we could, but with that the oscillators are the right frequency. The second one looks like constant, but if you repeat the calculation with a small variation in B, it'll look like E delta B over 2M. So this is the magnetic moment coupling to a small varying magnetic field, and that magnetic moment's existence was first uncovered by Simon Stern and Halpern, who said even in the low energy physics, that is stuff that depends on 1 over M. Then we have, finally, the Hamiltonian for the fermions. The pi squared term in the beginning is what you start with, and the second one is what comes by completing the square on the oscillator. But you notice that part of that sum, that is an I equal to j term, that sum is really not an interaction, but like a kinetic energy, which if you combine with the first one, if you put I equal to j, all those e to the iqs are gone. It still looks like a pi squared over 2m. And you notice that the new m that you end up with is a lot smaller than the old one by 1 minus this number, which is the number of oscillators over number of particles. So this is a very simple way to see that the minute you bring in these oscillators, you're increasing the M star, and you're quenching the kinetic energy. The more you have, the more you can quench, and the only reasonable thing to us at this point seemed to be to choose the number of oscillators to be equal to the number of fermions, in which case you just get rid of the kinetic energy. This is the only place where the number of oscillators even comes in. Otherwise, everywhere else you can do any number of oscillators you want. So with that choice, the only thing left in the Hamiltonian is just the potential energy, which we have sort of been ignoring all the time, but that's what's going to dominate the low energy physics. So to see the low energy theory, you have to write the Hamiltonian in terms of the electron density. So the electron density is rho, so this is the Hamiltonian, but rho will have a more complicated form in our final coordinates because we have done two canonical transformations. So if you look at our theory, you find the density as the first term, which is the usual form. The second one came from the transformation. Then there are terms proportional to the oscillator, which we drop because we're going to work in the lowest Landau level, which for us means put all the oscillator terms equal to zero, put them in the ground state. So this is the analog of the projected density. Then there's a constraint on physical states, which said curl A equal to rho. When you do the unitary transformation, interestingly, A drops out of the equation, and the constraints are entirely on the particles. They have to obey this condition. There's a number C that comes everywhere, which is a cosine squared in the theory, which is related to the fraction in this way. If you put C equal to 1, namely go to half filling, these two terms agree with what Donghai got from his own method, and what Paskey and Haldane got, they got the whole series, and this agrees with them for the two terms that we were calculating. But now that there are some problems with this density if you try to do any simple calculation. One is that its matrix elements go like Q and not Q square. Secondly, we always thought that these low energy particles should have a charge E star, which is the old E divided by the denominator of the fraction, but this seems to have charge 1 here. Then we know from Nick's work that the dipole moment should have coefficient 1, which got the wrong coefficient. And finally, the projected electron density should obey this Gurvin McDonald plasmon algebra, which is here. In the small q limit, that's a very natural way to truncate this algebra that obeys the Jacobi identities, where you drop the sign and just keep this one. So you expect it to obey this thing, but it doesn't. On the right-hand side, the first term has the right coefficient, the second one doesn't. Then we found there is one way to fix all these problems. That was to combine the charge density with a multiple of the constraint. Since the constraint is zero on the physical states, you can mix it with this if you like. If you take this cosine squared times the constraint, you get a density operator, which has all the right properties. You find the charge associated with the objects is now 1 over 2 ps plus 1. The dipole moment has gone back to 1. The commutation rules satisfy this. And then the matrix element somehow, the Q here and the Q here exactly cancel, and every matrix element is Q squared. So we like this combination, and this is the one we want to use for other calculations. Let me say that if you write L in terms of the L star, which is the magnetic length square of the composite fermion, you can pull out this common factor here. I want to write it this way because everything inside here depends only on the index P, but not on the index S. Whether you attach 2 units or 4 units or 6 units, as long as you fill P Landau levels, this depends only on P. So we took this density and said, can we compute some simple things with it? And one thing we wanted to calculate was the gaps for these fractions. So here is a way to calculate the gap. Ideally, you take the Hamiltonian, find the ground state energy, that's the second term, then find its expectation value in a state with the particle hole, widely separated particle hole, and take the difference. That's the gap. So for that, we were using P-fill Landau levels and the obvious excitations of the P-fill Landau levels and our Hamiltonian and all the matrix elements we know from earlier work. But what I'm going to show you here, rather than the actual numbers, which are pretty good beyond, I'll tell you where they work best. For the potential, rather than Coulomb, we use the one that is shown here. This is a model for problems where you have a thickness lambda. And the Fourier transform of that is this one. We use this not only because most samples have some thickness, but also by increasing lambda, you can bias the problem towards small q, which is where we have more control. Then, if you do this calculation, you can see without too much work that the answer is going to look like the square of these factors we could pull out, then some integral over Q. Most important thing to notice is that all the matrix elements depend on P but not on S. So you can deduce two scaling laws without doing any work. First one is, if you go to very large lambda, namely very large thickness, then F can be evaluated at zero argument, and F of zero is just one. Then you can see that the ratio of gaps for any two fractions is the ratio of square of the inverse square of the denominators. A more interesting law is that at any lambda, not necessarily very big, if you go from one value of S to another value of S, all the change happens in the front. There's nothing in the integral. They're all the same. Therefore, the ratio of the gaps will look like this. The ratio is the same for both, but here P is held constant and S is varied, but lambda need not be very large. But here, lambda has to be large, but you can take any two fractions. So we then started working with Park and Jane, who are doing these huge Monte Carlo calculations for this gap, and I will show you what happens to those two scaling laws. So here's the first one. You can see that the ratio of the gaps are large. This is a dimensionless thickness, and that's the ratio of the gaps. This is the ratio that's asymptotically predicted. And our theory itself hasn't reached the asymptotic value. These are the numbers they get from the simulation for two different ratios. What's surprising is that in the small lambda region, somehow the ratio of gaps calculated in the theory does very well compared to the ratio that they calculate. The actual values are not very good beyond a couple of magnetic lengths. For very thin samples, the actual numbers are not good, but the ratios are very good. Then, there's a second scaling law, which says that if you know the gap at one-third, in one-third, remember, you have three quanta per particle. You kill two of them, then you're left with one, and you fill one lambda level. In one-fifth, you've got five quanta per particle. You kill four of them, you're again back to one lambda level. So the top line is a one-third gap calculated for various thicknesses. The lower curves, one of them is the one-fifth gap directly calculated. Another is the one-fifth gap from our scaling relation. So you can see that given the one-third gap, you can really determine the one-fifth gap using this law. And given the two-fifth gap, you can say very good confidence what the two-ninth gap is. In the third fraction, as you have very big denominators, things never seem to work very well. But anyway, this is what you get. But still, I will sort of claim that if you give me some sample with some thickness and you tell me what your one-third gap was in your sample, I could probably tell you in a few minutes what it will be for some other fraction just from these laws. Okay, now, after this work, and also for some time, I've been trying to understand more the mathematical nature of this theory we're working with. And there are some things I was not happy with and some things I didn't understand. I'm only beginning to understand some of them now. So I wanted to share them with this crowd before I write anything on it so I can get some feedback. The question to me was, why does this strange combination that we formed, remember rho minus c squared times constraint, why does it work and what's going on? So all we had before by just the straightforward calculation was these two formulas for chi. So if you look at these two expressions, if you take a commutator of a rho bar with a rho bar, you get the right structure constant times rho bar, but the first term is right, the next term, higher order in Q, doesn't work. Similarly, the chi's don't close algebraically, and rho commutes with chi to leading order, but the next order something goes wrong. So there is the higher order terms are bothering us. So CP2 then is my second contact with the general on what I should do with his higher order terms, and he said, if you can get all the big powers to work together, you can solve the problem. So I guess I said, you mean coalition? He said, no, I mean exponentiation. So what he was really saying is, look at these two terms as part of an exponential series. Then that's an obvious thing you can do. Just look at that, e to the iqx times 1 minus something, but exponentiate this one and this one. In other words, I'm trying to find out a theory that's defined for all Q that reduces to this one, but that has all the right mathematical properties. That you get by writing them as exponentials. If you write these two exponentials, you find some interesting properties. First of all, they will close algebraically, because whenever you multiply two such exponentials, it will be a third exponential of the same form, because you can use the Baker-Hausdorff formula to combine them. So chi and a chi will commute to give a chi, you're guaranteed. So will rho and rho. But for me, the most interesting part is that with these combinations, these two coordinates commute for all values of all these fractions, for all values of C. So rho and chi will commute. And the commutation rules for rho and chi look like this. So this is what one can guess is the theory for all Q that we'll have, that we can infer from these first two terms. Now, Paskey and Haldane have a theory that I would say is at C equal to 1, that fermions are zero field, that coincides with this when you put C equal to 1 here. That's a very nice theory, mathematically very complete. This one is sort of easier to see where everything came from, and it also works for all the fractions, but sort of complementary in their utility. So we have to really make a leap from here to here. So now, one way to do the problem then is to write the charge density in terms of this rho, then you'll have a Hamiltonian, and the constraint will commute with it. That's a very good mathematical problem. And that's the kind of approach that Nick has been working on now, where you take the conservation law seriously and do a calculation that respects them. But in that calculation, if you use the density, you don't really see the monopole, and you don't see the dipole, and you don't see, in fact, an M star. They're all sort of latent if you write it that way. You have to use the constraint to see those properties. But then the reduced charge is not ever the reduced charge of the electron, because we know that the whatever notion one has of a composite fermion is really a union of an electron and a vortex. I claim now that the first density is the electronic density, and the second density is the vortex density. I say that because if I look at the commutation rules, and I look at the magnetic length that comes in this guy compared to that one, it's minus of that L squared divided by C squared. That means it's an object whose charge is minus 2PS over 2PS plus 1. That we know is the charge of the vortex. So this is then the charge density of the vortex. And since the vortex is really produced by the harmonic oscillators, you cannot have that collective coordinate duplicated in the low energy sector. So the constraint, just like in Bohm-Pine says, you cannot have a collective coordinate in both sectors. So you've got to freeze that. That's why chi is zero. But now if you form the object which is made of the electron and the vortex, what will its charge be? Its charge density will be the electronic density combined with the density of the vortex with the appropriate value of charge, which is the combination that we actually stumbled on by just fiddling around. So that is the combination of the low energy object. So if you want, you can work with that combination in these exact exponentials, and that, pardon me? Okay. And that exponentials will combine to give you this algebra. You see, it's not a perfect algebra. It doesn't really close on the right-hand side. But if you now replace the signs by the small q values, you will find, interestingly, in fact, you reproduce the algebra with the leading term, with the q cross q prime commutation rules. So another way to say this is that in the exact formulas, if you look at these two series, the nice thing about this combination is that when you subtract it from the first one, three interesting things happen. In the first one, the charge part will be reduced to correct charge. The dipole will get, this will add to that and give you the correct dipole. And the third term precisely cancels when you multiply by C squared and subtract. It's that vanishing that makes it possible for somebody who truncates the first two terms of the combination to get an algebraically closed formula for the density. Okay, so I would say that there are two options for people who want to work on this. Either you can use this density where the composite fermion properties are obvious, but the Hamiltonian will commute to the constraint, the given constraint. Or you can work with rho double bar where the properties may not be so obvious, but the Hamiltonian will commute to the constraint to give zero. So these are the two ways in which one can deal with this problem. Now, one of the primary reasons we had earlier on for working on all of this is to work on nu equal to half. So nu equal to half, you can of course do all of this, and you must be very, very careful in handling the constraints. And this issue was discussed in some comments in PRL that Murthy and I responded to, comment by Halperin and Stern. And the whole question is, at nu equal to half, can you have fermions that look like they got dipoles, and can they still be compressible? Any simple-minded calculation will tell you the compressibility will go like Q squared. The question is, if you put the constraints in properly and do a calculation where constraints are respected at all stages, can that Q squared go away? My belief right now is it is yes. I've seen it done in so many different ways. And I think that's one of the things we should try to resolve in this conference while all the interested parties are here. So there are other applications to this, of this collective coordinates, that I don't have time to talk about, but I'm trying to convince you that the procedure is fairly simple. You can take it home and you open the box and you can start using it. You don't have to read too many instructions. So I encourage people who know anything at all about the other problems to consider that possibility. Thank you.
The model, the scale, this is about the scaling laws for the gap that you showed. The model that used for the potential is bad for the real system for large lambda, because for very large lambda, the potential is really logarithmic, not a constant, right? But that's where really the calculations are, in some sense, the scaling law is better, in some sense.
Okay. The only experimental comparison we did was with some sample of a lambda is 2.5. Oh. So if you look at absolute numbers, this theory will tell you something to 25 or 30%. The more interesting thing for us to see, we will pick the potential just like that, and then Jane will put that in his computer. Then we'll compare the numbers just to see how well this theory does.
With the same potential.
Yes. In fact, a very large lambda, it may not even be in this quantum Hall state. Yeah.
This issue of finite compressibility, which was the point with our comment, in order to get the finite compressibility out of the model in which you're working in terms of the dipoles with the constraint, it's important to make sure that the Hamiltonian satisfies the symmetry, which is that, first of all, which has been known for some time, actually, due to Haldane's work, and which also comes out of this transformation, and that is that the when you add a constant momentum to every particle, it doesn't change the total energy. And then that folds back with the constraint to give you the right, to give you a finite compressibility. The second thing is that in order to try to do it systematically, what we did was introduce a finite, instead of having a very large number of oscillators, we consider a model in which you have the Chern-Simons interaction is cut off at some wave vector Q, capital Q, which is small compared to the Fermi wave vector. And when you do that, then in the limit where capital Q is small, then RPA is exact, and you can calculate the compressibility, not just the fact that it's the finite compressibility, but actually try to calculate the numerical value of the compressibility, which is in fact just the free fermion compressibility in this limit. You can try to calculate this just directly using the Chern-Simons approach that Nick and I and Patrick used basically in our original 1993 paper. Or you can make the transformation that you're making, come out with a new Hamiltonian for these low energy dipoles. The Hamiltonian we come out with is more complicated than the Hamiltonian that you have in your that you had in the original paper. There are two more terms which are of the same order necessary to keep in order to get the properties right. And then we do get the not only finite compressibility, but after keeping these terms, we get
the same
compressibility as you get without making the transformation. So the two descriptions do
coincide. I mean, for me, the real mystery was, can you have your dipole and also have the old compressibility? It wasn't obvious you could. So I think these things have sort of told you that you can either work in the middle representation before you do any of the things we did and compute compressibility. That is very easy to do a gauge invariant calculation. If you go to the final objects, then the objects are more complicated, they are composite, and it's harder to do calculations with them. But in the Hamiltonian, you can see all the properties very obviously. But the calculation has to be correspondingly more complex. But the interesting thing is you can get back the same results.
Okay.
You want to comment on that?
No.
No. Okay.
No
time. All right.
Make
well,
a very long comment next week for people that are at the workshop.
Okay.
It'll be about an hour and a half.
I was just going to describe your work in great detail, but since you cut me off, I think I'll.